find David where we left him last week at the cave of Adullam. Now, this week, by the way, let me say before I get started, what we're going to do in this particular study is I'm not by any means meaning to teach the life of David. We're teaching from the life of David and learning lessons from this man that God called a man after his own heart. And I get so much encouragement from the life of David, very much so. Aren't you glad that the Lord put in the book just the truth and he didn't goose it up like so many of the ancient writers did? You know, when you go back in archaeological searches and read their writings, you find how they don't do anything but brag on themselves. And they tell how wonderful they were and how many peoples they conquered and how great it was. But when you come to the scriptures, you find the absolute truth. God tells it the way it was, and he doesn't try to brush it up and make it look better. So I find in the life of David so much to comfort me. For one thing, if you've ever missed it in your life, you'll love David. Because David missed it and then re-missed it again. And yet God calls him a man after his own heart because he was just that. So we take great encouragement from that. David, the schemer, you recall how he tried every maneuver to work out for his own self what he thought God's plan was. Remember that God had, through Samuel, anointed David to be king, probably when he was about 18 or so, and had anointed him to be the king, and then he met Goliath immediately afterward. And such a marvelous victory. And David knew what God's plans for him were, and yet he did not have the kingdom in his hand. And he went and he was in the household of Saul, learning the ways of the court, learning how to be a king. And still the kingdom was not in his hands. And then Saul turns against him. Everything begins to run downhill. Has God ever told you something and went on vacation immediately afterward? And you got no more news after that? You know, God said something marvelous, and suddenly he was unapproachable in that subject. It appears that we are, being the finite creatures that we are, we expect everything to be done not only in time, but in our time. And we don't look at time the way God looks at it. And God will make a statement, and we thought he meant yesterday, you know, if not sooner. And it wasn't that way. Many times, the thing that God has said to us, we are in no condition or position to walk in. And it would be disaster for us if we immediately stepped into it. God speaks the end of a matter, and we're still at the beginning. And the walk takes a while. And nevertheless, we think we're all ready. God, knowing that we aren't, allows us the privilege of knowing what all of this will come to be as we're walking through it. And God, through Samuel, anointed David as the king. And then Saul turned against him, and David ran for his life. And last week we spent a whole hour in looking at how David schemed, how he used this method and that method, how he wormed his way out of this situation, how he lied his way out of that one, how he maneuvered and drew other people into his web of deception and his web of wiggling, and how it all spiraled down until finally he found himself at Gath, in the land of God's enemies, having to feign madness, depreciating and defacing his manhood and his humanhood by even allowing the spittle to run down on his beard, a mark of the highest honor for an ancient man, and how all of his schemes brought him to this pass. And it's the same with you and I. You cannot scheme and work your way out of circumstances. David, remember, is a covenant man, a man who understands the covenant, and this makes it even worse. Would be one thing if he was in ignorance of God and of his methods, but that's not the case with David. This is a man who knows the covenant. We know that he knows the covenant because he spoke of covenant when he fought the giant Goliath, remember? He said, "You come to me with a sword, but I come to you in the name of the living God." He was so knowledgeable of covenant that when Goliath threw out the challenge, David said, "Who's going to go?" Not knowing that the challenge had been thrown out every day for weeks and weeks and weeks, and everybody was scared spitless to step out there and fight this big hunk. But David knew the covenant. It's bad enough for some person fresh out of the world, not knowing anything, to fall. But when a covenant man or a covenant woman begins to scheme and to work out things in their own strength and their own intelligence, things have come to a sorry, sorry state. And that's where we left David. He wound up running from everyone, running from everything, alone in a hot, desolate desert cave called Adullam. There he was. And people began to come to him. And he learned that he was responsible for the death of a whole village of priests. An unspeakable thing. How would you like to have to live with the burden of conscience in the knowledge that you, by your scheming and refusing to commit yourself to God and his methods, had caused the death of so many people? Well, so many preachers. They were Levites. He had to live with this. How on earth did David handle this? How on earth could he manage to handle it? I have a friend of mine that had an automobile accident in which a child ran out in front of her car. And the child was hit by the car and died. And this woman was in no way responsible. And yet, it took her nearly a year to come to grips with this fact that she had occasioned the death of a human being. It was a frightful and a fearful thing. And here David faces the fact that he has occasioned the death of so many innocent people. And not accidentally, but because of his scheming, he was responsible. And we read over in Psalms 52, if you remember that, turn over to Psalms 52 real quick. You cannot understand the life of David without spending some time in the Psalms. For the Psalms are the writings that are squeezed out of the life of men who have absolutely been abandoned by everything and seemingly have been abandoned by God. And you have to understand that this is the essence of the life of these people under great duress and pressure. Psalm 52, David says down at the fifth verse, he says, God will break you, speaking to the wicked man Doeg, who was responsible. God will break you down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent. And he will uproot you from the land of the living. And the righteous will see it and fear, and they'll laugh at you. David did not settle into anger at the man who actually perpetrated this horror, but he said, I know that justice will prevail, and this is what will happen to you. I can afford to feel pity for you because you are in the hands of God. And then he goes on down into the eighth verse and he says, but it's for me. Now remember, this is the man who is responsible for the death of this village. He says, but it's for me. I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. You know, we sing that, I'm a tree, I'm a tree, I'm a green olive tree, never knowing or thinking that when he said that, he said it under the knowledge and the pressure that he had been responsible for the death of a village of priests. And we sing it and bounce and feel so good. This came out of the pores of the suffering of this man. He said, I'm a green olive tree. I'm responsible. What I did was sin, but this is the way I am. I'm a green olive tree in the house of God, and I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. I'm always amused when I see forever and ever. I mean, how much more ever can you get than forever? But then he says forever and ever, to just to be sure you understood the completeness of this thing. And he says, and I will turn my face to you, Lord. I'll give you thanks forever because you've done it. And I'll wait on your name, for it's good, in the presence of thy godly ones. He said, I will wait for you. Today, I'd like for us to think about this man, David, who has been such a failure. The anointed covenant man who is such a failure. Alone in a desert cave. It's at this point that a radical change takes place in this man's life. This change has either taken place in your life or it will, please God. David, the schemer, who has had faith, but in himself, in his own abilities to escape, to connive, to arrange, to change circumstances. David, who has depended on himself, and in the process has lied, lied, lied. and in the process has spiraled down, 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 has wound up, and David, something is dying in David. Something dies in this man. I want you to turn, if you will, to Psalms 141. Now, in this psalm, we get a look at a death and a resurrection. Psalms 141 says, O Lord, I call on thee. Listen to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. David is alone, forsaken, with the guilt of the knowledge of what he has caused, with the knowledge and guilt of his failures, with absolute hopelessness. Have you ever been there? Have you ever tried every plan you had it all turned to dust in your fingers? Have you ever done everything you knew to do and nothing came of it? Have you run to the end of your rope and found nothing but the frayed ends there, and you were hanging on to the very last wisp of that rope, and you said, Oh, God. You know, that's the most eloquent prayer that can be prayed. Isn't it a shame that it takes us so long to get there? But David said, Oh, God, listen to me. Yet there's a book put out within recent years about an old Italian mama, and the name of it is Hey, God. She didn't know how to pray. She says, Hey, God. And this is what David, he said, Oh, God. Hey, God. Remember when Peter stepped out on the water and he got his eyes off of the Lord and began to see the storm and he began to sink? What did he say? Oh, Lord. He began to cry out, Help. That's the most eloquent praying that can ever be done. It's then that, as old McGee says, the rubber meets the road. I mean, all of your flowery terminology has gone down the drain, and you're getting down to it. You say, Oh, God. My God. David prayed. He said, Listen up. He says, Give ear to my prayer, and give ear to my voice, and let my prayer be counted as incense before you. He's referring now to the holy place in the tabernacle where the incense and the sweet fragrance rises to God. He said, Let my prayer be sweet to you, God. And then he says, Let it be like lifting of my hands as the evening offering. He's in the cave now. He's all by himself. He says, Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Bless his heart. If anybody ever needed it, he did. He said, I know I'm a liar, and my lying has got me where I am right now. He said, Oh, just zip me up, oh, God. I'll never say anything else as long as I live. Have you ever said that? He said, Oh, God, help me to keep my mouth shut. Oh, yes, yes, yes. He said, Keep watch over the door of my lips. I mean, I'm not able to do it. Somebody's going to have to manage it. He said, Don't incline my heart to any evil thing. He said, to practice the deeds of iniquity when men do wickedness, and don't let me eat of their delicacies. He has seen that he has been feasting at the table of the flesh, and he's wound up so hungry after all of his dining. And look down in Psalms 42. He said, I cry aloud with my voice. I make supplication with my voice to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I declare my trouble before him. Now, I'm afraid that many times we Christians are the greater liars, greater than David. You see, this man has died to his own ability. He says, I am washed out. I have nothing else to do. I've tried all my tricks. My bag of tricks is empty. I can do nothing else, and it has gained me nothing. I've tried it all. Something is dying within him. Self-reliance, self-confidence. God helps those who help themselves is dying within him, because that is a lie, you know. I can manage it on my own. I can think of one more thing that might work. It's dying in him. And in the dying, there is rising to life something else. It's coming to resurrection. Faith in himself is dying, and faith in God is rising up. But one cannot come. Faith in God does not appear until faith in self dies. And many times we find ourselves dying to our own self-reliance. Faith in faith will not do it, friends. It's faith in the God of faith that will do it. And David is dying and being resurrected here. And he says, I am pouring out my complaint. Now, David is a man here who is letting it all hang out to God. Now, there is a teaching that goes about And I don't think it's an organized teaching so much as it is a supposition that attaches itself to certain teachings. And that is that a real Christian who is really walking in faith never doubts, never fears, and never fails. And all three of those are exactly that, hogwash. You know, if you were really in faith, it would all be lovely and hunky-dory. That isn't true. But once you do doubt, how do you handle that? You know, it's not a sin to doubt. Did you know that? It's not a sin to doubt. Sin comes about determined on what you do with those doubts. You know what the word doubt means? It comes from an old English word that means double. It's just it, double, and it is shortened into doubt. And it's the same word that is referred to when Elijah spoke to the people on Carmel. He said, "How long will you halt between two opinions?" It's the idea, in the Hebrew, it means having one leg shorter than the other. It means limping. It means, you know, going back, or it's a fella who can only stand on one leg, so he's hopping back and forth. He's on this leg a minute, and then he's on this leg a minute, and then he's on this one. He's just hopping back and forth. He can't make up his mind. And to doubt is to be double-minded. James says that a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways, all his ways, not just those that concern the area he's doubting in, but in all his ways. And it's a man who's given himself over to this hopping, this limping. So it's all right to doubt. Doubt simply means you've got two opinions. Well, you can't make a choice until you've had at least one to make a choice with. So when you're faced with two opinions here, what am I going to do? Then it's what you do with it that makes the difference. If you stay there and you hang on to those two opinions, well, I don't know, well, maybe it could be this way, but again, it could be that way, and you're back and forth, you become unstable. If you're only on one foot and you're going back and forth, you'll lose your balance eventually. You become unstable. So when your two opinions present themselves, or two possibilities, it's what you do with it that makes the difference. Because if you feel guilty because you are doubting, because you doubt, you're feeling guilty for thinking, friends. Things aren't going to come written to you, concrete and everything with a period at the end and all the I's dotted. You're going to have to make choices, choices, choices. And until you're presented with two things, at least, you have no opportunity to make a choice. So you're constantly going to have doubts that come to you, doubts that are put into your mind. But it's what you do with them that makes the difference. Now, we're taught, or the inference is given, that a Christian never doubts. He's absolute sure and steadfast, and everything is clear-cut down the line. And, of course, nothing is further from the truth. You're constantly going to be making choices. I choose this in spite of that. And the person who will not make a choice is a doubter. He's an unstable man in all his ways. He's neither fish nor fowl. He has no place. David, in the cave of Adullam, pours out his doubts and his fears to God. You know, there's nothing wrong with being afraid. There is a healthy fear. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, a fellow who's getting smart fears the Lord. There are other fears that are protective fears. I'm a bit nervous and fearful around a wild beast, like that bat I was telling you about I trapped in a peanut butter jar. You know, that's a healthy fear, because that rascal will bite you, and they carry all manners of disease. But to give oneself over to the principle of fear is to doubt every promise in the Word of God. To give yourself over to fear is to doubt the promises of God. In fact, it is an insult to the faithfulness and the character of God. Fear may present itself, but do what David did. He said, "I pour it out before God. I take my doubts. I take my fears. I take my failures, and I pour them out before God." It's how to handle the situations of life that we need to be instructed in. Because life is going to meet us head on, just like it met this man. And life is going to meet us without sparing us. And we need to know how to handle it. We have this little set of rules. You know, a Christian does this, and a Christian doesn't do that. And, of course, that's ridiculous. A Christian is one who knows how to handle life rather than allowing life to handle them.
He is learning how.
And remember this, we're called disciples. A disciple means a learner. And if you got it all right the first time, you wouldn't be a learner. You would be an instructor. And there's only one instructor, and that's God. We are disciples. We are learners. And learners indicates that there's a possibility you're going to miss it sometime. But don't get all bent out of shape when you miss it. Just dust yourself off and start out again. Learn from where you missed it.
God doesn't get upset. Remember, I always say, you know, your husband knew it, your wife knew it, your neighbors knew it. Nobody's surprised but you. So just get up and go on. It means that we are learning. And in the process of learning, it indicates you're going to miss it. So many people are so afraid to exercise the gifts of the Spirit that God has placed within them because they're afraid of making a mistake. And they say, well, you know, I wouldn't want to miss God. And that's a lie. That's such a lie. You don't want to make a fool out of yourself. That's what you don't want to do. And you're scared that you might look stupid to somebody, or somebody might make a remark about you, or that you might not appear to such an advantage. And so we rob ourselves because of fears, not because of the circumstance, but fears of our own failure, because of our own lack of a good self-image. So here's this man, David, in the cave of Adullam, and he's pouring it all out before God. He said, when my spirit was overwhelmed within me. Have you ever had your spirit overwhelmed within you? Have you ever panicked? Friends, I have panicked. Now, I'm not bragging about it, and I just assume not panic again, but I have panicked. Now, when I say panic, I mean when you come up against the end of it, and there's no place to go, and you've got to go someplace instantly. You know, you dast not make a decision, and yet you must make one immediately. Have you ever been there? And your brain begins to twirl, and all of your subconscious begins to rattle, and, you panic. Every part of you panic. You become frantic. And your spirit is overwhelmed. You say, this is too much for me. This is too much for me. There, I have seen the time when, because of faced with an extensive situation, part of me wanted to suck my thumb and curl up into a ball and die. Just exit from living. And there are those who exit from living. And the other part of me was furious with the first part that it wanted to quit living. The other part of me said, hitch up your britches like a man and quit being such a baby. But there was nothing wrong. It was a natural thing. You see, we need life. And life will hand you what life has. But it's knowing how to handle it. And when your spirit is overwhelmed within you, it doesn't mean that you've missed God or that God has left you. It means that you've reached an impasse. It's time for God to take over. But as long as you hold on, God is not going to prise your fingers loose. David had reached an impasse in the cave of Adullam. He said, my spirit was overwhelmed within me. And he said, thou didst know my path. Now, friend, that's the next statement to make. That's the next statement to make. Is, this is too much for me, but God knows where I'm at. God is not overwhelmed. He said, in the way where I walk, they've hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There's no one that regards me. He says, I'm all alone. Nobody understands. And he wasn't lying or being a baby about it. He's telling the truth. Nobody understands. There's no escape for me. Have you ever been to where, friend, there was no escape for you? I mean, you were dead if you did and dead if you didn't. Have you been there? No escape. Nowhere to go. No more tricks to pull out. No more schemes to involve yourself in. I mean, you had reached the end. This is it, boys. This is it. There's no escape for me. He says, no one cares for my soul. Now, that wasn't exactly the truth, but I know just how he felt. I can sympathize with him. I have said, nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. Nobody loves me. And then he said, I cried out to thee, O Lord. Now, here you're going to see what to do with despair, doubt, defeat, the absolute bottom line, no escape. What do you do with it? He said, I cried out to thee, O Lord, and I said, thou art my refuge. The word here refers to the same word that's used in Psalms 91, the same word where it says, blessed is the man that abides under the shadow of El Shaddai, of the Almighty. The same word that's used over in Genesis 1 where it said the Spirit of the Lord brooded or hovered over the face of the waters. The same word, the same concept that when Jesus stood on the Mount of Olives and he said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you to myself under my wings like a mama chicken, but you wouldn't let me. This is the same word, the refuge, the hiding place, the secret place. He said, everything has turned to dust in my fingers. I've run out of myself. I'm at my wit's end. I am in despair. I've come to the end. There's no place to go. I will snuggle under my God, my refuge. I have a place to go. And that place is under the wings of El Shaddai. under the pinions of my God. If you've ever been around a farm very much, you've seen the baby chicks with the mama, how when danger comes, she clucks and everybody runs under mama. If there's a hawk circling and she sees a shadow, everybody comes to mama. Many times, if there's a fire in the barnyard, you'll pick up the charred remains of the mama chicken and find the little balls of fluff run. They found refuge under mama. And when mama moves, everybody moves with her. You know, they go right. Nobody gets out. And every so often, you'll see a little furry feather stuck out or a leg, but it's hurrying real fast. It's under mama. So when mama moves this way, everybody stays right under mama because there's danger about. David said, "Now, you are my God. You are my refuge. I'm in this awful, awful, desolate, despairing circumstance. Boy, do you have a problem, God." That's what it means to walk in covenant. He said, "As for me, you are my refuge." You see, he turned all the attention from himself and turned it to God. He said, "I said, you are my refuge and my portion in the land of the living." He said, "I don't have anything in this world anyway. You are my portion in this world. In this life, all that I look for, you are. When I come right down to the bottom line, everything that I could expect out of life, that's you. You're my portion." He said, "Now you listen to me, Lord. You give heed to my cry." Now this is not a man who's tossing off a few prayer requests. You know, if you're not too busy, Lord, when you get time. Look, he is crying out to God. He's pouring out the innermost being of his own person before the Lord. He said, "Give heed to my cry. I'm brought very low. Very low." He says, "Lord, your baby is in trouble." And then he says, "Deliver me from my persecutors." He says, "For they are too strong for me." Now that's real wisdom. He says, "I'm in a mess. I can't go any place. I've got to do something. And they're too big for me, God. But they're not too big for you. My problems are insurmountable, but not to you. You're able to take care of them." Then he says, "Bring my soul out of prison." I've been in a prison. My soul has been in prison before. Been in prison with bars more real than metal bars, locked in, with no escape, no way to wiggle. When I was in the hospital a few years ago, I was in a coma and it was in intensive care. And because I was so wild and so strong, they had to tie me down. It is horrible to be tied down. Horrible. To be tied down and not be able to escape. Some people have a horror of being locked in a closed room or being locked in something. Suddenly this panic, "I've got to get loose. I've got to get out of here. I've got to get loose." Hits you. Called claustrophobia. And you say, "I've got to get out." And many times this happens to us. Our circumstances hem us in. And we are tied down. And they clamp us and we cannot move. We are helpless. And we suddenly panic and we fight what holds us down. Now, they tied me down to keep me from hurting myself or hurting somebody. And it was in mercy that they strapped me down. But I panicked. I became wild with terror. I was helpless. And I discovered that helplessness brings terror. Absolute, unmindful, unreasoning terror. To be helpless. And when your circumstances and your situation binds you down where you cannot move, you are hemmed in, you cannot get away, terror strikes. And you go wild with fear. It is a horrible situation. He says, "I'm in prison, but you bring me out. You bring me out that I might give thanks to you." His reasons for asking to be delivered are that God may be praised and thanks. He said, "The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me." In the midst of this horror, he makes his spoken word of faith. He said, "The righteous will come to me. They don't know where I am, but you know where I am. You give them your map, and they'll come to me, and you will deal bountifully with me." Now, his circumstances have not changed, but his attitude has. Now, when you get in this situation where there's no out, there's no release, and you're tied down tighter and tighter and tighter until you get where you can't even move your limbs, as it were, in the situation. Then you may relax, knowing that God is the one who will bring you out of your prison. Now, David knew how to handle fear, and he knew how to handle doubt. He knew how to handle life, and he handled it in the name of the Lord. He said, "O Lord, this is your problem. I'm in covenant with you. You have joined yourself to me with an unbreakable oath. This is not my problem. I was thinking that it was my problem. And I tried to help you out, God, but I couldn't. Now you're on your own, Lord. I'm in the biggest mess, and I'm fearful. Terror stalks me on every side. I'm afraid I won't my mama. And so I look to you. You are my refuge." Which one of those cartoons that says, this is a job for Wonder Woman or Superman or something? I always think about that when I think about it. Because he says, oh, this is a job for God. This is a God thing. Do you remember the covenant that says, I'll write my law on their hearts, and everyone will know me, will have an intimate relationship to me, and I'll be their God, and they'll be my people. Remember that says, I'll do all the God things, they'll do the people things. You know, it's not hard to do people things. It's when you try to do God things that mess you up. We don't have facilities to do God things. And so we need to decide, now, is this a people thing or is this a God thing? People things are things like trusting, leaning, learning, following. If this is a people thing, well, then I can handle it because God has given me facilities. But if this is a God thing, then God's on his own. I can't help him out at all. I find that 95% of our decisions is deciding, is this a people thing or a God thing? People things are easy. You do them naturally. But God things are rough. Only God can do a God thing. And David recognizes himself, now I'm in a situation that this calls for a God thing. I can't do anything about this. I've tried and I have busted my nose trying to do it. I can't do it. This is a God thing. And so he called out to God in the cave. He says, no more will I flee as a bird to my mountain. So I tried that, and that didn't help me out any. I will now flee to my refuge. Now, I want you to notice something here. David's circumstances have not changed. They haven't changed. So many times we are taught that when you come to God, everything is going to be wonderful. Were you told that? Did you think that? You know, all you got to do is declare Jesus is Lord and all your problems are going to be solved. Friends, you hadn't found out anything yet. You know, you had any problems until you suddenly declare Jesus is Lord and you decide to discover what problems really are. We think that being delivered means the absence of those adverse circumstances. That's not the kind of deliverance I'm talking about. That deliverance is there ultimately, but it's not the primary and most important deliverance. You see, the Lord never promised to deliver us from our circumstances. He said he would deliver us in them. Remember the three Hebrew boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They were delivered in the fire before they were delivered from the fire. Always, friends, always. It's a principle with God. You're delivered within the circumstances and then out of the circumstances. But sometimes you never are delivered out of the circumstances. And I may as well be honest with you and tell you that you may not be delivered out of your circumstances, but you'll be delivered in the midst of them. You know, the scripture says that we reign. Know how it says that? We are the reigning ones. One day, I was rolling my hair, washing my hair, and I was in the dressing room and putting my hair up. And the Lord, I was thinking on these things about reigning and ruling. And the Spirit of God, of the Lord spoke to me. And he said, notice, I didn't say you would reign over life or over your enemies. I said you would reign in the midst of them. Now, it's not that much to write home about to reign over your enemies, you know. But reigning in the midst of your enemies, now that's something else again. That is something else again. So the Christian, the man or woman of God, is not the one who has everything going well, and the Lord gives them everything they ask for, and all of their little guinea prayers are answered. The man or woman of the covenant is the one who can trust God because of an intimate relationship with Him, even when He does not choose to answer the way we thought He would or the way we would like for Him to. There are places in God, and I use the term places advisedly for want of anything better. I'm not talking about a physical place. I'm talking about a state. There are places in God that seem very undesirable to us, that seem very painful to us. And we say, the devil has done this, when it wasn't so at all. The devil may have been the tool that God permitted to be used to bring us to that place, but it was all of God from the beginning. For God desired for us to be brought to this place in Him, that He might deal with us as He could not deal with us any other place. There is a cutting action of God that goes on within us that we fear and don't like. It is a distress to us. And our flesh and our soul cry out, no, no, spare me, Lord. But God in love does not spare us, because He loves us purely, and pure love wants the best for the one that is loved. The best. The highest. Have you ever taken your kid to the doctor, and they screamed and pitched such a fit it took you and the doctor and the nurse to hold them down? You know what I'm talking about? That kid feels like, Mama hates me. She has lost her mind and gone stark raving mad. She hates me. And that young'un fights and becomes strong as a horse, and it takes three to hold him down. You know what I'm talking about? We're the same way. We say, oh, God hates me. The devil's after me. And God doesn't love me anymore because I hollered and He didn't answer. And look what has happened. This is horrible. I can't bear this. I can't stand this. I'm dying. It's killing me. It's killing me. And God says, I know. I know. There is that in us that must die, that there may be a resurrection of that which is preferable, chosen of God. David is in the midst of dying here. There is that in him that God is cutting off, and the surgery is painful. But from that is springing something that he could never know, and that is the God of faith. He had faith in God to start with. He really did. He knew he was anointed. He just wanted to help out. But now, he has something better than faith in God. He has the God of faith. Now, in the midst of his circumstances that have not changed, his faith in the God of faith can flower, can grow, can strengthen. And David is delivered in the midst of his circumstances. And he learns what it is to walk with God. Turn, if you will, to Psalm 63. We'll just deal with a few of these. Psalm 63. You see, a little time after David had all these men drawn to him at the cave of Adullam, he went up against a village of his people that were being attacked by the Philistines. And David went up to defend them. It was a walled city. And David went to defend them, and after he had defended them, someone got the news back to Saul that David was in this village, and it was a walled village. And Saul says, I've got him right where I want him. And Saul mounted up his posse and came to catch David. David heard that Saul was coming, and David went to Abiathar. Remember the young priest, the only survivor of the village of Nob, who is now the high priest. He was the heir apparent to the priesthood, the high priesthood. And he has the ephod, remember? He went back, and in the ephod, remember, there is Urim and Thummim. David has the mind of God because he has the high priest, and he has Urim and Thummim. And he's been anointed king by Saul, and only the king and the high priest can use Urim and Thummim to find out the mind of God. So David inquires of the Lord. Anytime you see the Bible talk about inquiring of the Lord, that's what they're talking about. David inquired of the Lord to find out, shall I go up and deliver this city? And the Lord said, yeah, go and deliver them. You'll find this in chapter 23 of 1 Samuel. And so David went up and delivered the city, and when he heard that Saul was coming, he inquired of God again. He said, will Saul come up to get me? Shall I leave the city? Will these men give me over to Saul? And the Lord said, yes, they will give you over. Leave. Now, I want you to note something. Here we have the man who lived by his own schemes and devices. He lived by his own wits. He outwitted Saul when he escaped from his apartment house and his wife made the bed roll up in the household image that looked like him. He escaped from with provisions at the city of Nob, where he lied to old Ahimelech and got the consecrated loaves of bread. He escaped into Philistia, into the city of Gath, and he escaped from the king there and wound up where he is now. And suddenly this man who has lived by his wits is inquiring of the Lord. He's learned something. Something has happened. Something has died and been resurrected in this man. Suddenly he is not living by his own abilities and by his own schemes. He's saying, Lord, what will I do next? Lord, shall I go this way? Lord, what will happen here? What do you want me to do? We've got a different person here. In the cave of Adullam, there is an empty grave where this man's death to his own ability died and was buried and was resurrected, a covenant man of faith. And he'll never be the same again. Never be the same again. He's learned that he can't trust himself and he can't trust others, that all will fail, and that his strength lies in the living God. He is a true covenant man now. He inquires of God what to do. And so after he left this village, he wrote this Psalm 63. He said, my soul waits in silence for God only. From him is my salvation. Oh boy, what a transformation. What a transformation. He says, he only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be greatly shaken. Now, I love that. I love that. He said, I can't depend on anybody. I can't depend on myself. God is my salvation. I mean, God is my strength. Not my own devices, not my own ideas. God. I'm in Psalm 62 here. He said, how long will you assail a man? Now he's speaking to his enemies here. He said in the fifth verse, he says, my soul, wait in silence for God only. I'm so impressed with the fact that he says, wait in silence. Do you know that most of the time when we come to God in prayer, we're so busy telling him stuff and informing the dear old gentleman that consists of our praying. We rarely, most Christians rarely pray. They petition. And maybe they will advance into praise. But friends, that's not what prayer is only. Those are portions of prayer. And usually when we come to God, the first thing we do is try to ask him to forgive us for all the rotten things we've done. We immediately turn our attention to ourselves. When the scripture says that we come into his presence with thanksgiving. When we come to God, our first attention is on him, not on us. In the first place, you shouldn't have all that stuff stacked up to deal with God. You should have been dealing with it one at a time as it arose. Then you don't have to, you know, fall down on the bed before you go to sleep and try to remember everything. You deal with it as it comes. And then when you come to a time alone with God, you can spend all your time in putting your attention on him. I heard Justin Cornwall say one time that used to, they would gather in their church, and when it didn't seem that the Spirit was flowing as they thought he ought to, they would begin to bind the devil. And they would begin to cast out, you know, the resisting forces and all of this. And I attempted to listen to some tapes by a gentleman week before last. And I gave it up as a bad job. But the first thing he said when he started all his teaching was, he said, now, Lord, we're come, like God didn't know it. He said, we've come to learn from you. And then he commenced to bind the devil from all the confusion and any sort of influence. We give the devil center stage 50% of the time. And Cornwall says they were there, and so they begin to bind the devil, and he says the Spirit of the Lord spoke to him. Said it was their custom, you know. And the Spirit of the Lord spoke to him. He said, I wish you gave me as much attention as you give the devil. And he says, I beg your pardon. And he said, well, you always pay attention to the devil first, and then I get what's left over. Hello, hello. Now, we need to be aware that we are standing in the finished work of Jesus. The devil, friends, has been bound. We simply declare it. Just declare it. He was bound by the finished work of Calvary. He was bound and led a captive. He was spoiled publicly Colossians tell us. The devil has been bound. Now, there are those who encounter that froth at the mouth when they hear me say that, and I've been declared heretic because of it. But I want you to know the devil's been bound. And we declare it because we know about it, and we won't let him get away with it. We say, oh, no, you have been bound. You don't have to bind the devil. All you need to do is wave under his nose the fact that he is bound. And you declare the finished work of Jesus. And believe you me, it leaves him nothing but a puff of smoke. He has been bound, and we know it, and we declare it. We declare, we don't turn our attention on the devil and begin to talk to him. We begin to praise our God for his finished work. That at Calvary he pulled the devil's teeth, and we're not going to let him gum on us. That at Calvary he arose victorious. That the devil has no power, that we refuse to acknowledge him any power at all, for he has been devoid of power since Calvary. And we declare the finished work of Jesus. He has been bound. We need to walk in that knowledge. To walk in that knowledge. Not to run scared or to be fearful of him. For the work is over. We just declare the work. And so, we come before God in silence. Now, many times, when you come before God and you've said all you have to say, you've praised him with your praise language, and you plumb tuckered with the whole idea now, you're ready to go to do something else, you has just got started. Just gotten started. Now is what you've really come for, and that is to shut up your little mouth and listen to God. The Lord this summer has placed me in an exercise that has been very difficult for me. He has secluded me and has picked me up out of my hustle, bustle, and my rush. And for 6 hours in the middle of the day, he has placed me in one spot. And he has introduced me into this new exercise that was, to me, new, I discovered. And he says, now, you know, spit it all out, honey, and get it done so that you can be quiet. So I have been spending for the past year, really, intensively, the summer months, time before God in silence. That's the hardest thing I ever did in my life. Do you know that you can't cut your mind off just because you want to? Have you ever tried to be quiet before God and your mind darts in 1,500 different directions and you pull it back and say, nope, we won't. You've got your attention on the Lord, and then it darts over here, and you grab that thing and pull it back. First thing you know, you're 2 miles down the road yesterday sometime, you pull it back over here. You spend all your time getting your mind shut down. Well, now, let me tell you one of the tools God has given us to shut down that racing mind and unlock your ear. I guess I mentioned this before. I'll do it again. The tool God has given us is called fasting. Now, we don't like fasting, and I lead the bunch in not liking fasting. My flesh despises it, and don't let anybody tell you they can't wait to fast and pray before God because they're lying. They're not telling the truth. Nobody likes to fast. Your body don't like it, just don't like it. But what is the purpose of fasting? Fasting does not do anything for God. It's not for God. He has no real interest in it for himself. Fasting is for you, and he knows the benefits of it. Now, I'm like Kenneth Hagin. You don't have to be a plumb fool about fasting, you know. Fasting can take many forms. Its purpose is to deny the flesh. For one reason and one reason only. You don't get brownie points with God. All you get is hungry. It's getting healthy for you, but just physically. But other than this, it doesn't give you any spiritual thing. Other than this one thing, it turns down the volume of your flesh. It turns down the volume of your flesh. Now, if I called you on the telephone and I began to give you some information and you said, would you speak a little louder? I can't hear you. Well, I might speak up a little bit. And you'd say, I can't hear it. I'd say, no, I'm not going to talk any louder. I hear the TV back there. You're going to turn that thing down. Now, friends, there's a whole lot of times when God is speaking to us and we never hear him. And then there are times when he's speaking to us and we say, would you speak up a little bit, please? I didn't get that. And he might speak a little louder again. And then we say, one more time, please. And he says, I'm not saying nothing else. You turn the volume down. And fasting denies your flesh. And it says, I'm not giving you what you're clamoring for. You hush up. I'm listening to God. fasting gives you a tune. You know that kids in college many times will not eat until they've taken their exam because it causes you to be mentally alert. You know how when you eat a big meal, the first thing you want to do is take a nap?
Right.
That's just normal. And food dulls the senses. Food does. But also, the flesh will dull your spiritual senses. And satisfying your flesh will dull your spiritual senses. Now, there's a lot of ways to fast. You can fast with food, but it doesn't have to be food. It doesn't have to be food. It could be anything that satisfies your flesh. Your flesh, I'm saying, I'm not talking about your body. I'm talking about your old nature, that me, mine, first me, what I like and what I want. And if you do fast with food, you, as Hagin says, you don't have to be a plum fool about it. You don't have to fast forever, and you don't have to fast from everything. You can fast from one meal a day. You can fast from something that you particularly like and enjoy, that you, is your custom and your habit. You can say, no, indeed not. I'm listening to God. I'm putting that aside for now. You can fast any number of ways. You don't have to be plum crazy about it. You don't have to make yourself sick to do it. All you need to do is to deny your flesh. To deny your flesh. There was one time when I got badly ill. And now I'm not one that says that you shouldn't go to the doctor. Quite frankly, I'll be very honest with you. I feel like the man who is afraid to go to the doctor is in the same bondage that the fellow who's afraid not to go to the doctor. It's immaterial, friends. The first thing you need to do is see Dr. Jesus and find out what he's got on the agenda. If he chooses to use medicine, that's his business. But you better check with him first. Save is better on your pocketbook. It saves you a lot of wear and tear. You save yourself a lot of money and a lot of aggravation many times. But to me, medicine is a tool to be used. Now, I don't put any bondage on anybody, and I don't make a big deal out of it. Everybody go as God leads them. But I feel like it's like the electricity or anything else. I don't refuse to use the light. I flick it on if I need it. But I don't turn it on if I don't need it. And I find out sometimes I need that or don't I? You know, better. So anyway, when you go, one time I became ill and with a bronchitis, which is what it was anyway, something that was giving me difficulty. And I was sick. I mean, I wasn't just feeling bad. I was sick. You know what I mean? I was rotten with it. And I had a very simple remedy on hand to take care of it. And I had was in faith to the Lord, and I had a very simple thing I could do. There rose in me such an aversion to take that simple little medicine, I didn't want to do it. It aggravated me that it was in the house. And that's silly. And I'd say, well, that's stupid. But I'd say, Lord, I'm not trying to put you to the test, but I don't want to take that medicine. I just don't want to do it. I guess I'd rather be sick than take that medicine. I don't want to take it. And I had a particular matter before the Lord that I was desperate to know the truth of. I had to know God's direction. And so I was praising God and making all of my confessions of what the Word said about me and constantly with him. It said, well, there's relief right there. There it is. Take it. I felt so bad. I'd lay on that bed. If you've been so sick, you'd go, just to comfort yourself a little bit. It just felt so much better when you groaned. But I was sick. And there was that stuff, and I'd get up from the bed, and I'd say, well, this is ridiculous. I can't even function. I'm going to go take my medicine. I'd get up to it, and I'd think, I don't want to take that medicine. I felt so horsey about the whole thing, I just didn't want to take it. So I didn't take the medicine. It was 2 or 3 days later, and I was still just so sick. Oh, I was sick. I wasn't getting a bit better. And suddenly I realized the answer to this matter that I'd been seeking God. It was just open to me, and it was so clear. And I had been distressed over it. And as soon as I got over my rejoicing with my answer in this matter, I thought, well, you know, wouldn't kill you to take the medicine. Why don't you go ahead and take it? And I laughed. I said, you know, I don't care one way or the other now. It makes me absolutely no difference. I went and took a dose. I said, well, I'm going to take it just for grins and giggles. This is ridiculous. And I was instantly healed. Now, you don't get healed from being as, you know, I mean to tell you, I was terrible. I was sick, and I was 2 or 3 weeks getting over. I was healed. It wasn't the medicine that did it. I really wasted my dose. Could have saved it for some other time if I needed it, but I wasted that little pill because I was instantly healed. And as I was just kind of muttering, thinking about that thing, making up the bed, and I'm leaning over here smooth, and the Spirit of God says, well, dearie, has the Lord ever called you a... He said, well, dearie, see, you just put yourself on a fast, except it happened to be medicine this time. I said, well, what about that? I didn't want that thing. The Spirit of God within me was withholding me
from what was relief that my body wanted it, but the Spirit of God was withholding because I needed to know the mind of God. Now, I'm not using that as any illustration or any foundation or any pivot for anything. It's just an illustration to show shutting down the flesh. Fasting can be anything, friends. It can be whatever the Lord points out to you is a good idea. But it shuts down the flesh. It says, take care of me. I won't. Soothe me. Take care of me. And you say, no, man, you hush up. We're going to listen for God. We're going to hear what God says. Getting quiet before God is a listening time. Now, if there's a matter that you have desperate to know the mind of God, I hardly recommend fasting. And like I say, you don't have to be a plumb fool about it. And you don't have to do it 44 hours either. Sometimes it's good just to shut down business and get quiet before God. You'll find it's hard to get quiet, but this shuts you down. It says you may as well hush because I'm not going to give you what you think you want. You're going to listen to God. And you'll find that God will begin to allow your mind to get still, to get still, to get still, until you'll find yourself tiny before God. Tiny, tiny, tiny. I heard a man say that he'd been fasting for a number of weeks over a matter, and he was a fanatic. And he had been fasting, and he said when he began to get still, it took him several days to get quiet, said when he began to get still, said he became tiny before God, and he was afraid to breathe lest he miss what God was going to say. You'll find yourself getting still, still, still. I invite you, or I challenge you, to get still before God. And when you do, grab those racing thoughts and just bring them right back. Grab your mind when it runs over you and get quiet before God. And you'll find yourself coming away from this solitude before God, having communicated. Now, God doesn't communicate the way we do. We string a bunch of words together, and it may take me 15 minutes to say it. When God speaks, I got it, just like that. He dumps it into you in a package. You got it. God gives you communication is not just information. I'll give you some information, and you can put it with your other store of information, but God doesn't communicate like that. God gives you himself. You following me? God doesn't give you information. Yeah, sometimes he does, but that's not his. That's a human way of communication. God communicates not facts. God communicates himself. And receiving himself within you, you come out with the facts. You come out with the revelation of that thing. But what you received from God was not information. It was himself. It was himself. You are realizing God. You know what I mean when I say realizing God? You are actualizing the person of God within yourself. And God gives to us his self. And we translate that into facts and information. And have you ever had a time where you knew something and you could not say it? You didn't.
You know that you know, and then the facts begin to come.
Yeah, but you can't articulate it. You know what I mean? And eventually you may be able to, but it always falls short. You never quite say it. That is because God has communicated to you himself. And himself cannot be translated exactly into human language. That's this book is a communication of himself to those men, and they translated it as best they could into terminology, but it falls far short of what they actually were trying to say. But it's the best that they could do. This is what I think of the Bible as baby talk, spiritual baby talk, because I'm a baby. And God has accommodated himself to me and to my limitations to impart to me something of himself that I can receive. So David got alone before the Lord, and he cut out all the talk. He says in the Psalm 63, he said, O God, and remember that's where we started, on the floor in the bottom of the cave, the dust of the cave of Adullam, he said, O God. That, by the way, is Elohim, the same word that's used over in Genesis 1 primarily. It is God in his creative capacity, Elohim, the God of creation, says, Thou art my God. I shall seek thee earnestly. Now, only those that are covenant walkers can say, You're my God.
people can know God exists, and they can know there is God, but only we can say, my God. The New Covenant says, I shall be their God, and they shall be my people. We say, my God. I mean, you're not just God. You're not just the great Elohim. You are my God. You see, we belong to God, it's true. But the marvel is that in our belonging to Him, He belongs to us. And we say, my God. Not just God abstractly there somewhere, but my God. He says, I will seek thee earnestly. My soul thirsts for thee. This is a situation where you find the more of God that you know, the more you desire. I was talking with Raymond and LaVon, and we were talking about some tapes we'd listened to, and I told them they were absolutely juicy. They were so good. I said, what else you got? And they just laughed. Isn't that the way it is? The more you have of God, the more He satisfies you, the more dissatisfied you become, and you become satisfied with a dissatisfied satisfaction. To be satisfied with God sparks you to further desire. And He said, you're my God. I'll seek you. Well, those terms seem to be out of balance. How could you seek what's yours? He said, you are my God. I desire you. He said, I'll seek you early. I thirst for you. David has come from the schemer to the man who is helpless. Helpless. Blessed are the poor in spirit, says the scriptures. Those that are spiritually bankrupt. Those that have wound up on the dust of the cave of their despairing circumstances. Those are the blessed ones that say, I have no spiritual strength. I am helpless. Because they are the ones that can say, you are my refuge, God. You are my salvation. You are my God. As long as there is any spark of self-reliance within us, we'll use it. Have you noticed? Have you noticed? And God in His mercy allows circumstances to come along to completely unmask that self-reliance and show it for what it really is, utter helplessness. God is, through your life, in mercy, bringing you to helplessness. Because, as Paul said, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. As long as I have any strength, I will attempt to use it. And then I'm just left with my little morsel. But when I realize my utter helplessness, then I turn to God, and all of God is at my disposal. Boy, am I ever strong. Am I ever strong. And so we have this man who is the anointed of God, who has come through, in spite of the fact that he's God's chosen, he's come through this death to himself. And he's wound up on the dust of Adullam, a helpless, dependent babe nestling under the wing of the God of all supply. He has come to helplessness. He has come to glory. It is in utter helplessness that we are strengthened. It is in utter helplessness that we can call out, you are my God. And this is where God is bringing us. This is where God is taking us through all of the circumstances of our life. That we can say, I am utterly helpless. I have no ability of my own. I was always so impressed with Brother Lawrence, who was a Carmelite monk back during the 1600s. And he said that when he sinned, he said, he just confessed it to the Lord. And he said, well, you know, Lord, that's the way I am. And if you take your hand off of me, I'll be just like that again. And he said, and then I went on my way. He said he went into the monastery thinking that he would be allowed to suffer and to be in affliction for his great sinfulness. But he said God had sorely disappointed him because he had found nothing but satisfaction there. Don't you love that? Don't you love it? Nothing but satisfaction. In helplessness, we find utter satisfaction. We come into the strength of Elohim, the strength of the Lord Himself. David has, as the commercial says, come a long way, baby. He's come from the schemer to the helpless one. And in it, he has found his destiny. He has found that which God causes God to call him a man after my own heart. He has found himself,
ruling and reigning in the midst of his enemies. For his circumstances haven't changed, but he's changed. The unchanging one has changed him. His circumstances are the same, but he has changed. Look for the last verse, verse 11 of Psalm 63. Well, we're back up to 9. He says, those who seek my life to destroy it will go to the depths of the earth. They'll be delivered to the power of the sword. They'll be a prey for foxes. Now listen to this. But the king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him will glory, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped. Who is the king that David's talking about? It's himself. What's he the king of? I mean, he's stuck out there on a sandstone throne, nothing but rocks and cactus and the disgruntles and malcontents of all of the country are there. But he says, I'm the king. I see things from God's point of view. I've been the king since Samuel anointed me when I was about 18 years old. He says, I've come these years through all of these crooks and turns, and I'm still the king. My circumstances haven't changed, but God has anointed me, and regardless of where I am, I look at myself through God's eyes. I'm the king. And that's where you and I will come to. God in his mercy is bringing us through self-reliance to the death to ourselves, into helplessness. And in all through that, we are still the king. For we're seated in the heavenlies. We reign and we rule in him. We are the king. And no matter how dry and barren your circumstances appear to be, how distasteful and impossible they appear to be, remember, you are the anointed. You are the apple of his eye. You are reigning in the midst of your enemies, regardless of what your circumstances might say. Father, in the name of Jesus, we bless and thank you for your unutterable wisdom. Lord, the wisdom of God so far surpasses our finite wisdom that it leaves us with our mouths open and our faces in the dust. And yet we acknowledge your wisdom, Lord. For by your wisdom you formed all that is. You spoke the world into existence. And by your wisdom you are confounding the wicked ones. By your wisdom, you are revealing yourself in your people. We are being showcased by you, God, that all that is may acknowledge the wisdom of our God. And we praise you for it. Thank you that our lives, by the circumstances of them, are in mercy bringing us to helplessness before you. Lord, deliver us from having to go to the end of our rope like David did. Lord, let us come to the end of our rope quickly. Let us voluntarily choose to announce that we are helpless before you and upon you, that we might be showcases of your glory and your praise. We delight in you, Lord, and in your ways and in your methods. You said that you showed to the people of Israel your acts of power, but to Moses you showed your ways. Lord, we want to be those that are privy to the ways of God, that understand your ways and are able to relax in the midst of unsavory circumstances, with our mouth filled with praise for our Lord. For we understand your ways and your methods of bringing to death within us all that's contrary to you, and putting and giving to us and placing within us of your own self, that we might be helpless in your strength. We praise you. We bless you. We acknowledge who you are, Lord. In the name of Jesus, amen.